inviting a few people to just talk from your own experience as to how this material on relaxing the sense of self has maybe become more real for you, experiential, in some specific application, concrete example, something like that, not conceptual, but down here. And then what I'd like to do is present some material fairly briefly about the networks in the brain that support open spacious awareness, which has relatively little sense of self in it compared to these midline networks that are saturated with self in it. And there's a particular kind of trick, in a sense, you can do and deepen in your own practice that both takes you out into these lateral networks and has the bonus of building up capabilities of going into unification of awareness or singleness of mind, which is the fifth jhana factor. So we'll do that. That'll probably take us to a break. And then coming back, I want to talk about liking and wanting, because so much selfing arises around wanting. And it's interesting that in the brain are actually distinct nodes in these reward centers of the brain that track liking what's pleasant, distinct from gotta have what's pleasant. And then also track disliking what's unpleasant, distinct from wanting the unpleasant to stop. Right? And that's pretty useful stuff, because it goes, of course, right to the center in Buddhism of the Second Noble Truth, that wanting, craving, thirst is the primary generator of suffering, both short-term and long-term. And then, with that as foundation, really help to explore healthy narcissistic supplies. The idea of taking in a felt sense of feeling valued, loved, included, seen, recognized, mattering, and so forth to others, that taking that in actually is a major way to undo a lot of drivenness around me, myself, and I, as well as feels really good, and it's rewarding and beneficial in other ways too. And then wrapped up again by, coming back to Bahia and his encounter with the Buddha. So that's kind of the ballpark, and then very close to one, and I'll need to leave fairly soon after that. But during the break in the morning, I'm happy to chat with people too. All right, so that's kind of the plan. Any logistical things this morning? Any logistical things we need to work out? Yeah.
Yeah, could you turn down the bass and turn up the treble?
Get that ominous rumble like Jaws. Actually, there's research that those deep subsonics, which is what they play in thrillers or horror films, are very alarming to us. We don't like it. And while we like a deep voice, a melodious voice, that real deep stuff, just kind of freaky. Anyway. Okay, so good. Good on you. Thank you. Plus, you're getting blasted by the speaker, which got moved even closer to you. Probably a little bit. I heard talk about deep subsonics. You can't. Okay, that's good. Okay, good. So, any more logistics for the morning? Okay, great. And as usual, if you want to get up other than during the break, that's perfectly fine. Okay, so any concrete examples in your own experience of something you've seen maybe related to selfing in your own mind? Anybody want to share? Ray?
So driving home last night from here to San Luis Obispo, I kind of practiced a little bit. Rather than I'm driving, just driving was occurring. And then I often am triggered by driving, and so sure enough, somebody did something I thought was pretty stupid, and so I thought I'd try, anger's arising, and upset's arising, and a whole story about what an idiot this guy is arising, and that was a lot, and then it was like, and now it's going away, how about that, and now green hills are arising, and all that other stuff, and the flexibility of that was so nice, whereas otherwise it's all rigid and I'm right and they're wrong and I know what's happening and why it's happening and everything. That's all I stuff.
Yeah. any other examples? Yeah, in the back. Great. I think it was especially like that, of course, when you know you're in a room with people who are deliberately practicing that way or attempting to. But it's also true often in general that the truth is other, just like we, when we go through life and annoying things happen, we might have a little thing about it, but we tend to not turn around, lock on to who that person is, take their name and number, hunt them down like a mad dog later, you know, take care of them. No, we're just like, it's just like those bubbles, that little bubble popping, like the metaphor I used in the surface of the mind. You know, we don't matter that much. It's brutally awful and wonderfully freeing. We don't matter that much to others. Most of the time. There are a few people we matter a lot to, but most people, we don't matter that much. We're traffic, we're noise, we're part of the puzzle, and a momentary annoyance, or like a gnat that's sort of annoying at the worst, and then they move on. And it's hardly personal. And that's amazingly freeing to kind of appreciate that. You know, we can lighten up somewhat about managing the mind stream of other people or reacting to it. But we don't figure that significantly in their mind stream. Other people? Concrete examples? Yeah. Yeah, thank you for saying that. A piece of material that will be in the slide set that I'll send you. I don't have time to do it, and it has its kind of own life. It comes from the work of the neurologist James Austin, who's a longtime Zen practitioner, and he pulled together a lot of really interesting stuff in his book, his third book, Selfless Insight, and then there's one after it where he takes it further. But the distinction is that in the brain, we have two basic perceptual modes, which then become elaborated into ways of thinking and feeling. And one mode is where, just as you said, we see the world in its objective nature. That's called allocentric, not centered on ego. It's centered on everything. So it's just things are what they are. And they're not in reference to a particular perspective that has our name tag. That's allocentric. So, and then the brain tends to cycle between that way of regarding everything to an egocentric perspective in terms of why is it relevant to me? What is its salience to me? You know, in reference to me, this particular perspective. So minimally in reference to this person, which over time, you know, tends to get accumulated as in reference to the presumed I inside this person, right? And it's natural to go back and forth. And there's a place for regarding things in terms of their relevance to me, right? We're driving down the freeway, there are cars all over the place, and most of them are not relevant. The big truck right next to me that's been weaving back and forth, that one's relevant, you know? So there's a place for that. But a lot of times we relate to things self-referentially in ways that are just burdensome, that are unnecessary. I think we've had a lot of experiences of the distinction there, and now we can operate just fine without such a strong self-referential process going on. And being able to move out of that egocentric to more of a impersonal, it's not about me perspective is really quite helpful. All right. Any other personal examples? Yeah, please.
If I could stop coughing.
Yeah, it's so annoying, too. Where do you live? Yeah.
This takes me beyond, this takes me to a more helpful place than where I was when I was meditating before. I used to try to identify the thoughts that were coming up, labeling, categorizing, organizing. Mm. That just got me into more thinking.
Yeah.
I realize now.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying this. And when I reduce language, I reduce effort up here.
Yeah.
And I become more relaxed, and my mind is just more calm. I'm very, very grateful for this.
Oh, good. Yeah. That's great. Thank you very much for saying that. Yeah, I think in part you're referring to what people talk about as a noting practice, which comes from Mahasi Sayadaw, mainly where, you know, a little bit of a noting practice can go a long way, especially when we're, you know, a little agitated, like anger. Or pride, or desire. Okay, you know, that's fine. Or boredom, or sleepiness. There's a place for that. But to do that thing where you're just noting, you're right, for me too, it just sucks me right into the verbal. It's very complicated. A lot. The brain, again, is a giant network. And here's an important point. In this giant network, there are all these nodes connected to each other, all right? Well, let's say there's the network, the circuit that's related to worrying about something, all right, and getting preoccupied about that. Well, that circuit is comprised of body sensations, what are called in psychology somatic markers of that particular state of mind. That circuit's comprised of emotions like anxiety or subtle variations of anxiety. Maybe the worrying about bills is different than worrying about a child. It's different than worrying about a personal health problem, right? So there's various nuances of emotion, okay? Then there are various thoughts. And then there's kind of a point of view about it all embedded in that, as well as other things too. But the thing is, the way the brain works, if we activate any one of those elements of the circuit, it starts pulling up the whole circuit, which is a curse, in a sense, but it's also a blessing. Because if we deactivate any one of those elements of the circuit, it tends to quiet the circuit as a whole. And a lot of what's present in so many of our circuits of suffering is inner language. Inner language, which has content, right? It's inner language. But if we quiet inner language categorically, we don't just argue against that content with more inner language, which is, there's a place for that. That's cognitive therapy, where you're arguing against wrong thoughts with right thoughts, or let's say. But if you were to categorically, if we let language drop out altogether and we kind of move more into a kind of an awareness space that's really dominated by what's foregrounded in it are sensations and images and light feelings and a sense of awareness altogether, but very little inner speech, well, that really tends to short circuit a lot of neurotic spinning categorically. To me, that's what you're talking about. And when that happens, then too, as language starts dropping out, a lot of selfing is language supported. You know, we have an inner narrative. In fact, some people talk about the self as the narrative self. Another book that's interesting is Damasio's book, The Feeling of Being. You know, I think The Feeling of What Happens, or The Feeling of Being, that's it. Is that the title? It's in my last thing. Yeah. Well, anyway, it's in my slides, so right to have a list of books. But anyway, the point is, I think it's The Feeling of Being. He talks about the self as this narrative self. You know, again, this emphasis on language. So if we can just drop out language, so does selfing. That's great. That's good. Okay, any other examples? And maybe one last one.
I've often wondered if maybe one of the things to do in meditation is to sort of go to this prelimbic state. And I guess that's what you're saying. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Again, there are many kinds of meditation. There are many purposes of meditation. But yeah, I think a lot of what meditation is to settle into being with what's there rather than abstracted from it and caught up in a story where we're not here with what's there. And very often that story has one of its major engines is language, inner language. And if we're fighting the language, well, then that's tough. But if we pull out of it, the other thing that happens too is a lot of language, a little evolution here. So language centers on the left side are very related to motor planning centers and executive centers. Because as primates, for example, and other mammals evolved, they had to form plans for action. Okay? Well, language takes that form as well, where there's an actor and an action and an object of action. So we have nouns, verbs, and objects. Right? The bat hit the ball. Right? Bobby hit Sammy in preschool. Right? Actor, action, object of action. And so, and that process is very intimately wrapped up with the sense of being the executive or the chair of the committee inside or the ego, AKA the self. Right? It's all very connected together. So that's one reason why it's particularly powerful to appreciate that the person can make choices, have values, create plans, sequence actions in a skillful way without necessarily adding to that selfing. In the executive, let there be only the executive. In the choosing, let there be only the choosing. You know, that little practice I did with you about wiggle your fingers, wiggle your toes, and notice the distinction between there is wiggling, there is initiation, there is stopping, compared to I am moving my left little finger, I am no longer moving my left little finger. That was kind of a breakthrough for me when I was talking with Andy Alinsky once at Barry Center for Buddhist Studies when he said, you know, sure, you can have the executive functions occurring without turning those into self, without turning those into I. Those executive functions are very linked to skilled action and language. So, again, in this network idea, if we can help language drop out, we can reduce the sense of selfing. They all kind of entwined together.
Well, and how does this work in my interaction with you? Because I have to have language, so does that mean then I will always have an increase in selfing?
Great, so she says, so if we're interacting and using language, right, and does that not increase selfing? And it's a great question. And it's interesting to do language. Language, I think, is one of the hardest things of all. It's fairly easy to relax selfing when you're kind of sitting quietly and you're feeling good, right? No major threat, no major opportunity, no other person. The three main things that drive selfing, just an experience, and which makes sense in terms of its adaptive benefits and evolution, okay? Big sticks, big carrots, other people. So, but when we're talking, particularly when we're talking in a personal way, boys, it's so easy to have a sense of self arise. And here's where I think it gets really tricky. I think it's perfectly okay, and it's kind of inevitable. I don't know what's in the mind of an arahant, the fourth stage of awakening, in terms of this thing, but I know for myself, currently, even though I've practiced with this actually quite a lot, there are still these little thought bubbles, these little mini-movies, these little 2, 3, 4, 5 second cascades of the mind, that embedded in them is this implicit presumption that there's an I here. Okay, so that's what's there. So right there, it's very interesting. There is an implicit presumption of an I embedded in a perspective on something. I like this. I don't like that. After this workshop, I'm going to be driving north. I'm making plans about what I'm going to do on that 5-hour drive. You know, I'm going to see my wife and my one of my two best friends for dinner tonight. You know, like you know how it is? After this workshop, you can just watch your mind. I'm going to go home. Mm-hmm. I'm going to feed the cat. How's the cat doing? You know, whatever. You know, and we do that. Okay. That's really hard to get rid of, I think. Those little mini-movies that have an embedded presumed I in them. Like I say, you know, I think we've been probably on retreat or in really incredibly quieted situations, including a retreat with very little interpersonal contact, maybe. And the frequency of those little I-referential mini-movies starts dropping down. And we notice that. Maybe in the mind of someone who's very, very far along, they hardly, if at all, arise. But meanwhile, they're arising. And they tend to keep programming us into believing that there's that unified, stable, independent identity stuck inside us, what's constituting characteristics of the presumed I, right? What do we do with them? And I'll tell you two things that have been helpful for me. First of all, is to regard them as just one more content of mind, and then do the Vipassana strategy, do the Buddha strategy. Be with them, and then kind of tease them apart and look at it. What is it like to have a little thought cascade go by, or a little mini movie go on, or a little plan, or a little mini fantasy, you know? What is it like to have that go by with this presumed I perspective embedded in it, right? And then you look at that I perspective, and you ask yourself the Buddha's classic question, you know? Is this, what is this nature? And if you look at it, that little bubble, experientially, is transient, passes away like that. It arises based on conditions. It's connected to everything else. It's fundamentally kind of empty. It's another little eddy in the stream. It's a little foamy, fizzy, swirling of flotsam and jetsam, mental flotsam and jetsam, tearing on, and then it disperses. And in it, you can look and see, is there the presumed I, this really consolidated, unified, stable, whole package of a self, is that present in that little thought bubble? No. Direct inspection. You just watch it, and you go, is there an I in it? There actually is no I in it. The complete package of a presumed ego. And ask yourself, is there happiness in that thought bubble? Is there true happiness, fundamental happiness? No. That's a really good practice. Right? Because you can see directly, there really is no total package of an I in that little moment of experiencing that lasts 3, 4, 5, 10 seconds, maybe a little longer. And there's no actual deep happiness in it. So it's not worth clinging to. Right, that's number one. Number two, even though in these multiple little thought bubbles that happen, these little moments of experience, you know what I'm talking about? These little kind of cascades of experience, even though they happen a lot, and even though in them is this pointing to a presumed unified, stable, independent ego, I, right? Even though they point to that and it's embedded, they kind of assume that there is such a one, right? Can we ever find such a one? No one I know has ever found such a one, really, in their own experience. So even though they assume there's something, even though they presume and point to that entity, that being, there is no being. You can't find it. So the presumption is wrong. It's automatic, right? But it's not accurate. It points to something that's a unicorn, you know, that doesn't exist. There are real representations in those little thought bubbles of something that doesn't exist, this unified, stable, independent ego eye. Do you track those two things? You know what I'm saying here? If you look at it directly, you see that there's no I in it. Okay? There's just the scene in the scene. There's just the thought bubble in the thought bubble. There's actually no I in it. And second, the I that it assumes can never be found. And you can see this in your own experience. Bringing it out of concept down into experience. And that's very powerful to do that over and over again. So it's kind of okay in a sense. It's inevitable. You can't, at this level, I can't at least. I can't stop it from happening. I can't stop if I imagine what I'm going to do. Or if I think about my joke about my Reese's peanut butter cup, someone actually gave me just 2 Reese's peanut butter cups as donuts, so I appreciate that. But anyway, it just happens all the time. But then if you just let it be okay, and then you just don't privilege it, if you have insight about it, or in the Buddha's language, you get disenchanted around. You wake up from this spell that's continually cast by these little thought cascades, these 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 second little rifts in the mind that act like there's a problem. If you're no longer enchanted by them, you see through them, then they're not a problem. They're just kind of inevitable. They come and they go, and over time, the logs that fuel them get increasingly put on the fire through relaxation and practice and insight. But in the moment, it's okay. Maybe one more person, then I'll move on. Yeah.
Well, the thing, I guess when we set an intention or make a choice, it seems like there's someone
right
doing that.
Yeah, doesn't it? Yeah.
So what's up with that?
I think it's really interesting. Yeah, great. So, yeah. So, like, there you are. And, so you're making a choice, right? You stop with one thing.
Well, you're setting an intention that I'm going to follow this path and all the way through. It's something really serious.
Yeah, I'm going to go to the gym. Or what comes up for me as examples of that are survival situations, which I think are the hard case. You're in a situation where I'm going to get through this. You know, there are certain situations that really intensify the sense of I, right? Mm-hmm. Intense threat, intense opportunity, intense interaction sometimes. Here's a little thought experiment, by the way, that argues, which would you rather hear? Okay, ready? Which would you rather hear? You know, in this interdependent space, there's arising so much love. Or would you rather hear, I love you? I'd rather hear the latter. I love you. You know, I'm going to come through for you. And so I think there's actually a place for this, under certain conditions, it's beneficial for this kind of strongly coalesced sense of a particular, I think of it as like it's like a magnifying glass. You run sunlight, just sunlight in general won't heat up, but you can focus. It's like a focusing of agency, right? And willfulness around something. Right? So we experience that. We've all had those experiences, correct? Where we're willful, we're strong, we're determined. We're dealing with a threat, we're going to get that carrot, right? Or we're really going to come through for some other person. We're really loyal to them. We've had those experiences. Okay, let's look at them. What do they mean? What is it? So we have that experience. If we look closely at that experience, I think, see for yourself, it's made up of parts. There are somatic markers of that sense of willfulness. There's certain related emotions. There's often a kind of some thoughts around it. And there are sometimes different perspectives, like the perspective present in, I'm going to pull over this overhang and survive and not fall off this rock because my protection's kind of funky beneath me and I don't trust it, is a little different from, honey, I'm going to really come through for you. You're my daughter, you're dealing with something tough right now, I'm really going to come through. That feels a little different. So right there, we start having compoundedness and differentiation and multiplicity. We start having more of the symphony, multiple instruments playing. Even in something that seems really central, like, I'm for this, or I'm going to deal with this, Even there, we have what the Buddha's talking about, differentiation, compoundedness, many parts, and those parts arise due to conditions. So right there, we have the experience itself is empty. The experience of intense willfulness. Or I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to exercise. Right? I'm not going to put up with this anymore. I've had it with this treatment. You know, those experiences we have. We look at the experience. We do the Buddhist deconstructive strategy. We break them down into the aggregates, you know, this, of what the elements are of the experience. And we go, wow, it itself is kind of foamy. Experience. And then in it is this referent, is a reference to a presumed ego. Kind of embedded in it, built into it. Again, we can slow it down, we can look back at it, super slow-mo, and we go, you know, embedded in that experience of, I'm going to pull over the overhang, or I'm not going to put up with this anymore, or I'm really going to come through for you, or I'm going to really exercise from now on, whatever it is. There's this reference to, embedded in it, this presumed I. And I would argue, again, if we look closely at that actual moment of experience, in it is never a complete I, is never a complete ego present. It's always partial. It's funny, when you look closely at your own experience, it's always partial or implicit or kind of a referent to, a pointing to, which is what I said previously. And then, as always, we ask ourselves, is it ever found in a moment of experience, the complete presumed self? Is the complete presumed self ever found in a moment of experience? The complete package, the whole ego I. And I would argue that in any moment of experience, we never find it. It's endlessly presumed. We're tricked. Right? One way we get tricked is embedded in the way cognition happens altogether, the way thinking happens altogether. For example, if you just think about the perception of something, you know, like this cup, right? So the way the perception of that cup occurs visually, think about it, is all kinds of frequencies, wavelengths of light, land on the eyes. All kinds of neural activity occurs. It's just, it's a whole bunch of things happen. Right? That's what hits the brain. And yet, what the brain does automatically and fairly quickly is it turns all that stuff, all that heterogeneity, into one essential thing, a cup. It sees one object, and fairly quickly, it forms the category, cup. It what's called it essentializes. And that happens all the time. Like, we see another person. I'm like, look at you, a lot of visual stuff. But my brain super fast just goes, click, person. Category, woman, sitting. Just like that. And then we operate further with it. So the brain does that routinely, and that's what squirrels have to do with nuts. Nut. Tree. Rock. Rock is different from nut. Very quick, right? And then I know it's a nut there, and I know it's a rock there, and I don't need to think about it too much anymore. It's very efficient. So cognition is endlessly essentializing. It's a really fundamental aspect of what mental processing is doing. It's turning complicated swirls into coherent things. You follow that so far? Mm-hmm. You see that? We can kind of see it in our own experience, and you can kind of go, oh, yeah, I understand that. That's true. Well, the brain does the same thing with the sense of I. It has that strong essentializing tendency. It wants to find an entity. Like a cup is an entity, a nut is an entity, a rock is an entity, a tree is an entity. It wants to find an entity. It wants to find an essence. And it does the same thing to this fundamental matter of the presumed I. Like again, getting that, like, wow, it's quite poignant, actually, if you think about this in the backstory. Like, for me, the whole matter of Dharma is actually very poignant, because the First Noble Truth, of course, is dukkha, suffering. And why do we suffer? Well, in many ways, we evolved to suffer, because that's a great way to get animals to pass on their genes. We suffer the loss of carrots. We suffer the arrival of sticks. That's highly motivating to hold on to those carrots and avoid those sticks. Right? And it's poignant. Again and again, you see ways in which Mother Nature has done things like essentialization. Essentialization, that process I'm just describing, essentializing, is critically necessary perceptually for animals to function. You know, a frog, it cannot see the fly unless the fly moves. But if that fly moves, hope that wasn't too gross, it's going to get that thing. It entityizes it, it essentializes it, it thingifies it. The brain is constantly taking processes, verbs, and gerunds, and turning them into nouns. It's interesting that Pali, the language of early Buddhism, apparently doesn't have nouns. It just has gerunds. So it's not a dog, it's dogging. You know, it's not a tree, it's treeing, right? And so it's poignant that that's what the mind is endlessly doing, this reifying, thingifying, essentializing kind of process. And that got us here. It got us here 3.5 billion years later, 600 million years of evolution of the nervous system later. But it's also handed us a pile of woe. And so much of Buddha Dharma, so much of Buddhist practice is about using the faculties that Mother Nature has handed us to gradually undo and the machinery of suffering that Mother Nature has handed us as well. Isn't that poignant? This is quite poignant and touching. I feel actually emotional. You know, it's poignant to feel into it. And it, to me, it takes us to compassion. To, you know, each one of us has been handed, the day we were born, fantastic capabilities and tendencies, and also strong tendencies that just drive into suffering. From subtle suffering, tension, contraction, discontent, all the way out to real difficulties. Yeah. And then I'm going.
So, you were talking about evolution. So, before there were living beings or sentient beings, and the earth was just rocks and minerals and gases, is there mind there?
Oh, no. Dinner all over again. Is there mind there? Well, that's a great question. So, okay, so, right, was there mind there? So what do you mean by, first of all, it really helps to be clear on the words. And I promise you we will not get sucked into what the Buddha feared, a thicket of views about this. I'll steer clear of that. So what do you mean by the word mind?
Why would some teachers say that there is unconditioned mind?
Right.
And it doesn't make sense to me, because it seems like unless you have
right.
Being that notices, you know, something that it needs to eat or some threat from the outside, that just that it can't really, it has to be conditioned.
Right. Okay. So this is a really deep matter, personally. Someone said, you know, I remember reading once where someone said there either human beings are the only intelligent life in the universe, intelligent at the highest level, let's say, or we're not alone. And either possibility is extraordinary. I kind of think the same thing. Either there really is some kind of transcendental metaphysical X, or there isn't, and either is extraordinary, right?
But when they talk about unconditioned mind, is that possible?
Well, I'll just talk about Buddhism a little bit, and then I don't know what's true. I personally have the experience, and for me it's also based on reason, that there is actually a transcendental X woven into the nature of things. That's my take. And that's kind of a little outside the frame of this, but I'll just say that, so you know where my view is.
That's why you said you were a theist.
I'm a theist, yeah. In that sense. Okay. Now, that said, I ultimately don't know what's true. I won't say I think this is true. I think there is no self. I think that's true. I think there's a cup. I think those things are true. I will make those decisions. I think I will see my wife and good friend Bob later today, traffic willing. All right. I don't know about this deep stuff, although I have a basic sense and take. Okay. In Buddhism, now let's talk about what the Buddha taught and the evolution of Buddhism kind of quickly here. The unconditioned mind stuff, that kind of comes in with the Mahayana piece, 4, 5, 6, 7 centuries after the Buddha passed away. In the Buddha's time, and this is where a book like What the Buddha Thought by Gombrich, great book, because he really takes you through the history. Because I think the history matters. That we're in a lineage. I think it helps, without being a scholar, plus it's kind of neat to imagine, for me at least, the historical Buddha walking around, having his own awakening, struggling, reconciling with his family that he abandoned when he started his own practice, working that, dealing with people trying to kill him, dealing with kings, you know, a lot of high drama, and just what was going on in his head when he was teaching. I find that person kind of interesting. I offer that to you. So at the time, there was a belief in elite circles that he lived in, the religious folks of the time, fundamentally that the universe, that deep down there was Brahma, there was God, deep down, as it were. And then we had an Atman, a soul, that traveled, and the ultimate purpose of things was for Atman to become Brahman. Thou art that. That was the basic take. Okay. In that context, right, he described the path of practice, as best we can tell, in the best approximation of what he actually taught, which is the Pali Canon, the canon of books in the Pali language, the Nikayas, you know, which is the largest extent body of teachings of any major world religious teacher. You think about what Jesus purportedly said that's in the four Gospels in the New Testament. That's the Jefferson Bible, so-called. You know, he cut out everything but what Jesus said, and that's what Thomas Jefferson read every night. It's pretty interesting. But anyway, it's not very much. The Quran, thin document. The Pali Canon, it's big. It's really worth reading. You know, it helps to read it in good translation. It's not murky and good footnotes to clarify. But it's very psychological. It's not mystical. Very mystical at all. Okay. So anyway, in that canon, the Buddha described processes that leading toward complete awakening that made no reference to Brahma or God or, what was your phrase, unconditioned mind. He made no reference to that. What do we make of that? Okay. Minimally, he didn't think it was necessary for awakening. What he thought was necessary were the four foundations of mindfulness. He also described love as a fully sufficient path to awakening. That's very important. Love is a fully sufficient path, love broadly defined. You know, is a fully sufficient path to awakening. Why? But he didn't make any reference to this sort of cosmic stuff. So minimally, he said it wasn't necessary. Someone, to paraphrase a quote, recently wrote, "Science does not make it impossible to believe in God, but it makes it possible to not believe in God." In other words, it makes it possible to understand how animals arose without requiring the account of Genesis. Right? It makes it possible, maybe, to appreciate how we register the color red or the taste of an apple without reference to some mystical X factor woven into that. In the same way, the Buddha said, basically, it's possible to achieve full awakening without reference to Brahma or the divine in some way. Now, one could infer from that not just in terms of what's useful, but in terms of what's true, that he thought there was no God. You could infer from that. I think that would be not necessarily the case. He was very leery as a teacher in terms of what's useful, distinct from what's true, of giving people anything they could cling to. He endlessly, as I said, yanked the carpet out from underneath people. And even his own teachings, he said, should be abandoned. He used the famous metaphor of the raft. You know, we're faced with a river of suffering, we'll build a raft to get to the other side, but on the other side, we don't keep carrying around our heads. So even the teachings, including the language forms of the teachings, the linguistic concepts of the teachings, were to be abandoned as one approached the farthest shore, nirvana, completeness. So it could be simply a teaching strategy, and also he was to Hinduism at the time what Martin Luther in a sense was to Catholicism. He was Protestantism, in other words, to Catholicism. A lot of parallels there. Protestantism, kind kind of got rid of the priest class, and it made the Bible more accessible to people in general. The Buddha, much the same. He was not interested in empty ritual. He wanted to disavow the class of Brahmanic priests, who are the gatekeepers between people and salvation. He said, get rid of the gatekeepers. You can, if you practice hard enough, you can get your own salvation. That's profound. That was a radical thing. And he also made it available for anybody, men and women alike, Brahmins and untouchables alike. He had to be prodded, especially where women were concerned, unfortunately. But I think it was his stepmother who finally got him to see the light. She brought him home. Siddhartha, don't be a dick. No. I can't believe I said that. Anyway. Okay. So, where was I? So, anyway. So what do we make of that, right? He didn't argue against Brahma or the divine. He just didn't think it was necessary, at least as far as we can guess. Now, there is a little murkiness around nirvana or the unconditioned, the deathless, and people can sometimes read into that a sort of divine ground, if you will. I and others are a little wary of that strategy, because it seems motivated sometimes by a kind of wishful thinking or a sentimentality or an unwillingness to face the bare possibility that everything changes, nothing lasts, deal with it. That's what Andy Alinsky said to me once, you know, as his summary of the Buddha Dharma.
What about on the wheel of dependent origination? Is there something that leads to consciousness?
Well, wrapping really up fast. So, but it does get to this whole thing of self, you know. So seeing for oneself. So the point is, you know, there's a tension in Buddhism. You've got people like Stephen Batchelor over here, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist, strongly arguing against this tendency to bring God into it, and even arguing against the metaphysics of reincarnation. You know, he basically says it's possible to achieve awakening without believing in that stuff. And then you have others like Thurman, what's his first name? Father of Uma?
Robert.
I remember Uma, but the dad. Robert Thurman, the Columbia professor, or others. Ellen Wallace, very strong. And the Tibetans, very strong. Zen's pretty quiet on this stuff, but Tibetan Buddhism strongly emphasizes, really, some kind of a conscious ground. They call it different things that, you know, they talk about in different ways, but they emphasize that. So there is that tension in Buddhism. So, okay, we have, what is it? You know, a tent that can cover a lot of things. It's okay. And then we find our own way in it. And maybe I'll just wrap on this one. At the end of the day, while it's fun and fascinating, I think, and important to consider these ultimate questions of, is there a God? Is there not a God? Well, what do we mean by that if we say that? Blah, blah. At the end of the day, the question is, what helps? What helps and what hurts? Is it useful to practice? If it's useful to practice to believe in reincarnation, great. If it's not relevant, why give it much thought? You know, if it's useful to practice to really sense and believe in unconditioned mind, great. If it's an obstruction to practice, if it becomes one more thing to attach to and one more reason to kind of kick back and take it slow, because if we're all in conditioned mind anyway, why practice? You know, I'm not saying you're doing that, but the person could have to do that. Then don't do it. At the end of the day, you know, this stuff is very fascinating. And I read stuff, you know, I see a lot of people getting really into this. And I read it, it feels sterile to me at the end of the day. Like, it doesn't move my practice much, you know, unless it does. And my statement is that my personal intuition of something transcendental woven into the nature of things has actually been very meaningful in practice. As I try to allow myself to disattach from experiential phenomena, not cling. The strategy fundamentally in Buddhism is non-clinging. What supports non-clinging? For some, if it's real for you, if you have a felt sense of something transcendental that, in a sense, buoys you or lives you or catches you as you let go of clinging to moment-to-moment experiencing, that can serve your practice. And it served my practice. It has served my Buddhist practice. Okay? Let's take a break. Let's come down to the body and go pee. All right. So 15 minutes, 5 minutes to 11. We will come back.
Just keep telling you.